Hello, welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly and social manner. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely the opinions of the participants and do not represent any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Make sure you keep your conversations open for the public and on the level. To interact with us, you can send questions and comments to the YouTube chat. So hello, good evening to all of you watching on YouTube. And because we're live, I have to go fix Facebook. So I'm going to go fix that while we have the rest of the hosts go around and do their brief introductions so I can figure out what's going on there. And we'll start with Juan. Good evening, Juan.
Good evening, brothers. Juan Sepulveda here from Orange Blossom Lodge, number 80 in sunny Kissimmee, Florida. And the brother behind the gentlemansbrotherhood.com. And I'll lead over to Hambrecht, Brother Mike. You can introduce yourself, please.
Yes, Mike the intern, Hammy, or just plain Mike here from Lakeshore 307 in Madison, Ohio, where I am the current senior warden and lodge education officer, and I'm also senior steward of Castle Island Virtual Lodge. Good evening, everyone. And over to RJ.
Oh, hey. How's it going, everybody? Robert Johnson, Space Novum Lodge 1183, current sitting secretary and a past master over at the old Waukegan Lodge 78 in Old Town Waukegan, Illinois. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. And yeah, looks like Facebook's not cooperating tonight, but you know, we'll roll with the punches. So if you know people are watching over there, just send them over this way. So anyway, I do want to give a special shout out to all of the patrons who've been supporting the show. Help us get our Facebook issues figured out. So thank you for all of you. If you want to help contribute to the future of Masonic education, head on over to patreon.com/themasonicroundtable, where we will we'll be using that, give you access to secret behind the scenes type of things. There's little Facebook chats and the like. So it's a lot of fun to talk to you guys a little bit more personal on a personal level back there. So thank you for everything you do for the future of Freemasonry. So tonight, we are going to talk about a historical figure that I've been really curious about diving in and doing some research with. And so this gentleman goes by the name of Reverend Dr. Brother John Theophilus Desaguliers. So, you know, or you can just call him Johnny or Desi. Surprisingly, his friends called him Desi for short. So what fascinated about me about this brother is I'd always heard that he was the third Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge of England in 1719. So we're gonna dive a little bit into the man and the character that this guy was and some of the things that he did contribute to the fraternity as a whole. Let's see. I do have a couple of, slides here just to have something pretty to look at so you don't focus just on me because you don't want to see that. Let's head on over to John Theophilus Desaguliers. Okay, so this is the gentleman, Reverend Dr. Brother John Theophilus Desaguliers, which I always find interesting that his name his middle name, Theophilus, you know, I guess loosely translates to the love of God, the love of theology. Which is very apropos because he was the son of a Protestant minister. And he was, with the name Desaguliers, you would assume, rightfully so, that he was born in France. And then actually when he was young, moved to London where he set up a French school. In Islington. So he was there, but what was interesting was that his father, the pastor, actually died when John was only 16 years old. So he had this establishment, moved out of his home country, and while brilliant, even at a young age, and interested in religious aspects, he was fatherless at a very young age. And so that was one thing I learned the more research that I did. So as he advanced in life, we really don't know a whole lot about his early years, but we do know that he then started to go into grammar school and then entered into Christ Church in Oxford and got his Bachelor of Arts in 1709. And he continued on to get not only a master's degree, he then also got an honorary doctorate degree in civil laws and was then called Dr. Desaguliers in 1719. And then actually incorporated by Cambridge University. That honorary degree became an actual doctorate degree by Cambridge University in 1726. So very studious and actually loved to give lectures. Meanwhile, so this was, 1719, he got his honorary doctorate, but he was actually even ordained as a deacon in 1710, and then as a priest in 1717, which is interesting when you look at the timelines of early Freemasonry, right? 1717, we should all know that date as the founding of the Premier Grand Lodge of England. 1717.
The almost founding officially of the Grand Lodge of England?
Almost, sort of, kind of.
The almost founding?
The maybe?
The asterisk? What?
Or fraudulently?
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. There's been a lot of refute about that lately. A good piece in the recent Ancient Accepted Scottish Rites Research Society article. But I digress.
No, no, please. This is I love this because I want this style to be a little bit back and forth.
Oh, okay, yeah. There was a really great article that was published via the Scottish Rite Research Society in the latest hard book that they sent out. And I'm dying a little bit because I cannot remember who wrote it, but you'll know the name. It looks like Mike's got it.
Him, he's going for it. He's going for it.
Yeah. And, I read it and I thought, I don't buy it. It feels like these guys got it. It feels like the author of this article is attacking.
Was it Rick Berman? Because it's the one, Origins of Freemasonry and the Invention of Tradition, a rebuttal. Yeah.
Yeah. Rick Berman's rebuttal. And I love Rick Berman has written amazing things about that, but I just felt like Rick Berman was attacking the people rather than their argument. Hmm. But I feel like their argument was good too, so I don't know.
But as I was looking earlier, I won't go into this too much, but as I was looking at it earlier again, because I'm preparing to redo my presentation I did at the 300, I'm beginning to wonder if they weren't attacking a lot of the wrong things too, though. A little bit too much ad hominem attacks on Desaguliers and Sayer and so forth. Hmm. So. But I have to really reread it, so I'm not really criticizing it that way just yet. So nobody hang me out to dry for that.
Interesting. So so again, he's becoming a deacon 1710, priest 1717, 7 years later. So he's really good at lecturing. In fact, that's what he gets to be known for, is the way he can work a crowd, loves to give lectures, and in fact, you could call him like the early Carrot Top. He's like the prop guy because whenever he gives a lecture, he's giving fascinating demonstrations, which actually got him his foot in the door with the Royal Society in England because they needed a new replacement to their, forgot the term they called it, the demonstrator. So that way someone could describe visually what's going on. And so he actually ended up per Isaac Newton's request, who was president of the Royal Society at the time in 1714, invited Desaguliers to replace, Francis Hawksby as demonstrator in society's weekly meetings. And he just wowed Newton. They became very, very close friends. He apprenticed under Newton for quite a bit. Newton, not being a Freemason, not really, never was or really proven, but we do know that they all stayed in the same kind of circles. So, so Desaguliers is there and he's doing these demonstrations. He's setting these things up, and in fact, he becomes a fellow shortly thereafter of the Royal Society of, you know, the fellow of the Royal Society. Now, if you're not familiar, the Royal Society at the time was really the top brass of thinkers at that time. Of course, again, Sir Isaac Newton was a member of this. Elias Ashmole, who's kind of the first known documented Freemason, was a member of the Royal Society at this time. And so this was like the inner circle of the aristocratic scientific elite, if that makes sense. So he's hanging out in all these circles. He's making friends. He loves to talk, loves to give these demonstrations, and becomes very well known to give lectures. In fact, some even would say that some of his demonstrations that he gave were actually on the close of being like stage magic, because he would do things where he could make large copper tubes turn silver, like just in a flash, for dramatic effect. Of course, he could make a cork floating sink on command. He could do all these like weird things, all based in science. But it was his, you know, his bag of tricks that he had when he would give these demonstrations. So it really helped set him up for his, not flair for the dramatic, but definitely his experience and skill of orating, of knowing people, being in the right circles, and really having a good stage presence. And so I found that to be interesting, that he was known to have hundreds of demonstrations, right, of actual different props. Robert.
So I had a question, and it maybe boils down to like socioeconomic status of the day, but man, when you said that this guy has, he's both a doctor and he's a priest at a point, just in your research, have you found that like in order to get a doctorate like this required you to have access or to be somehow, I don't know, having a voice in the church? I mean, I know like, you know, Lutheranism is very much considered the religion that attached itself to the library, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if they were like mutually exclusive. I mean, a lot of times you always hear that the only people who ever got the education was to go into the church.
So, right? So one part of my research, really good question. Even though he matriculated at the age of 16, he was actually 22 when he actually went to Oxford. So there's this huge gap in time, and that's primarily due to his father's death in 1699 and had no money. His father left him nothing. So he had to earn his own living. So he really was a pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind of guy. So that was really interesting. So, and that's what I was trying to figure out. Was he born into money? Like, how did that work? Because it really wasn't clear on the first pass of research. But this guy, other sources that I gathered for this really show that he was kind of, he worked the crowd. Like, again, he knew everybody. He was well connected, and he was full of energy. Like, if you wanted something done, you give it to him, right? You know what they say, if you want something done, give it to a busy person, right? Because they'll find a way to get it done. He was that guy. Very charismatic, but also was everywhere. He was like, you know, he was just always hyped up, full of energy. And so I think that energy got him into those places that he needed to go and get access to those things. So that's a good question. Mm-hmm. So another thing that fascinated me, because another thing to note about the Royal Society at that time is that the Royal Society was actually, it was science light. There's a really good book that I read a couple years ago. I think it's called Clockwork Universe or something like that. I'll have to look it up. But really, it's not as, when we think science today, we think of, you know, running controlled experiments and really making sure that everything is, you know, you're dotting your I's, crossing your T's, and you're running it meticulously so that it can be created later. The scientific method really hadn't flushed out around this time period. So what we find is that science was really like Hey, I heard Bobby across the street knows how to turn lead into gold. Oh, really? That sounds interesting. Why don't you invite Bobby over? You know, and so it was a weekly meeting of scientific like minds, but they didn't have the rigor of a repeatable process. So the history of the Royal Society, while some really cool things came out of it, like Newton's, you know, gravity and all that stuff, laws of motion, that was a byproduct of being in with like-minded people, but it also, the other half of the time, they were really talking about things that were kind of on the edge of, like, pseudoscience.
A little alchemy, a little philosophy, a little, yes. You know, because wasn't there, I mean, isn't there publication, the Philosophical Transactions of correct. The Royal Society?
That's so, the name yeah. of their magazine, right? Of which, Desaguliers, through his career, actually published 60 articles for the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. So again, no slump either for writing as well as lecturing. So he's working hard, but remember at this time, now he's like an understudy to Newton. So here's where I want to kind of go off the path a little bit of the story, because you can't not just put him with Newton and then not really talk about Newton's influence to him. So again, we know Newton, Sir Isaac Newton was not a Freemason, but was very interested, you know, knew lots of them, did a lot of study in the sciences, the liberal arts and sciences. But another thing to mention is that that Newton himself, which I've been fascinated about, we may have talked about this in earlier sections, is that Newton was like a hermetic scientist. He was really into, what we got there, Robert? Yep. Isaac Newton's Freemasonry, The Alchemy and Science of Mysticism. I haven't read that one, but that looks like a great one. Have you read it? You haven't skimmed it yet?
No, the spine isn't even cracked. I picked it up at Half Price Books, but the title of, you know, I mean, Isaac Newton, such a handsome man, and having the title Mysticism and Science in it, I'm like,
I'll take it.
I'm all in.
Yeah. So Newton himself, one thing I found fascinating was that over 50% of all known Newton's writings were on alchemy. So we know Newton scientifically as, you know, gravitational fields and laws of motion and the like, you know, which really helps establish the framework for objects in motion in space, right, to give us our planetary system. But really, he spent more than half of his writing, maybe not his time, but his writing, on alchemy, on spiritual alchemy, and actually trying to turn lead into gold. Some of those have since been found and scanned, so I kind of encourage you to go look that up online to see if you too can turn lead into gold. But as such, here, I'm going to show you another piece of published work. This is actually a published work from John Theophilus Desaguliers, which is called A Course of Experimental Philosophy, published in 1734. And one of his lectures concerned Isaac Newton's recently established three laws of motion. So in this picture here, we see a planetarium or orrery to visualize the motion of the heavenly bodies in our solar system according to the Copernican system, which is more circular. By turning a crank, the planets and the Earth are set in motion around the sun. So this was a hand-drawn/hand-built contraption that he took Newton's laws and started applying them in here. And so heavily influenced by Newton at the time. Again, Newton also wrote a lot on the sacred geometry, divine geometry of King Solomon's temple. There's been lots published about his fascination where Newton thought that the dimensions of King Solomon's temple as defined, you know, in the Bible were actually kind of like divine proportions, and was truly trying to make something more philosophical out of it. So again, how could he study it that much and study alchemy that much and not influence Desa Goulier at the same time? So while we don't have any direct proof of Desa Goulier practicing the hermetic arts and sciences, he's in the same circles with these guys. He's talking to them every day, all day. So, you know, basically the conclusion is there's really no way that Desa Goulier was not an alchemist at this time. Remember, alchemy and science were still kind of one and the same, right? So you have a lot of the spiritual aspects. You still have the concentration of the church into the science as well. And the more that I read about what Desa Goulier published, going back to Desa Goulier now, I was fascinated to see how much of an engineer he was too. So, as an electrical engineer myself, I found that kind of cool, where he, let's see, here's another, picture of another thing that he's published where, he was actually known as one of the top 23 leading, scientists in the science of tribology. What is tribology? It's actually the study of fluid and motion and friction and lubrication. So here you see lots of different glass tubes with different fluids and air pockets in them and all these different ways you could shape them and form them so you could measure the hydraulics and you know, the pneumatics that go with that. So we know he's very good in the church. He's rolling in the hermetic arts. But now this is like no kidding a scientific legacy that he's leaving behind. In fact, we also know that he has several patents that you can go and search for and find those. He was fascinated with steam engines at the time. We mentioned hydraulics and studying motion, just all things motion fascinated him. He even studied the human body in motion. He would watch how people would jump off of things and try to get, you know, copy their muscle structure and figure out how things work. So at this point, with all of these published drawings and studying of human motion, I'm really getting a Leonardo da Vinci vibe out of all this. So, and that's just, I want you to really kind of get that image of him as a scientist, as an engineer, this whole time.
And what I found too, is I was doing some other digging here. He actually wrote some very interesting articles on electricity, created named the conductor and insulator, which I kind of thought that was something that Franklin had done, but no, Franklin did some other things, the battery and so forth.
And positive and negative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what I found interesting in that thinking is it's a shame for the year that the age and the years that Desa Goulier passed away, as opposed to when Franklin was actually in England, they missed each other. But they were contemporaries in reality. I mean, because they have, you know, yeah, they missed each other. They never actually met from what I could find so far. Which would be a shame with all the experimentation that also Franklin had done on electricity. Having seen that article, I was just like, wow, that would have been an awesome merging of the minds, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, you're getting all these scientific influences across London and the States at the time, too. So, yeah, I'm glad you picked that up because as an electrical engineer, I found that pretty cool to see him dabble in that space as well, on top of everything else that he was already studying. And an ordained minister and, you know, all these other things. In addition to the pneumatics, created a more efficient fireplace that was able to pull air in and make, you know, make the fire burn longer. And also a blowing wheel, which actually circulated air out of buildings. So when you have stale air in an old building, he invented a machine that would like suck the air out and pull it to the outside. So yeah, this guy
was today excellent. We would just call that an air handler, right?
Yeah, exactly. A fan. Yeah. So put a box fan in the window, you're good to go. So yeah, this guy was fascinating just from an engineering standpoint. And yet we know him much more for his Masonic endeavors, but I was just blown away by the engineering prowess. He himself could, you know, has done what, you know, multiple men couldn't have done in a lifetime. And It had to be access to Newton and that society. Robert?
John, I was going to mention, like, I can only imagine what people would accomplish today had we put so many people in the same room. I mean, I by no means am I like, this is not a love letter to Oppenheimer, right? But like, when they needed to make a bomb, Oppenheimer put together a dream team. You know, to be in the room of a dream team like these people were has to be incredible. I had another question for you, and it kind of relates to, you said, you know, the church at this time is involved in science too. And so, not to digress or anything, but I'm curious on your thoughts, you know, in that period of time when the church has like a vested interest in science, much like science, there's just an analogy. I'll just jump to it. The church interested in science to see the predictability or understand God better, as in maybe a mathematician or an economist might look at the market to see what happens with the market, right? Like, is it an investigation to predict or to understand, or is it like a legitimate thing that they're interested in because of the betterment of humanity? I only ask because I think there's a general malaise that a lot of people have today that would go, well, the church would never have been about science, right? Because it's like 14th century dad. You seen the meme, 14th century dad, the daughter says, I know math. And he's like, get the stakes ready.
Burner, she's a witch.
Yeah. Right. Thoughts on that just through your research, through that lens?
Yeah, I mean, so just in my understanding and study of Newton, the man, highly religious person. And so remember, this is still like early Church of England, right, where the church and the state are one, right? And so, you know, basically everything, like when you woke up and you ate your Wheaties for breakfast, that was because God told, you know, wanted you to, right? Everything was God inspired. Everything was part of the church. So even the science at the time was all through the lens of God, because that's everybody knew about God. So like the concept of a deist or an atheist, like would hurt their heads like that. So separating the divine inspiration from the science or from the math, that wasn't a thing. And so it's not to say, was there some sort of church influence to make, you know, to understand God better, or was there some sort of church influence to control science? It was neither. It was just that's the way things were. That's the way they always were. That if you weren't religious, something was wrong with you back then. And so while that did taint a lot of the science, again, how Newton, you know, just went, you know, almost insane trying to find these divine proportions, King Solomon's temple, for example, and study alchemy, spiritual alchemy, as well as operative alchemy. It wasn't to an end. It was because that's the way it was, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Oh, and just two other things, some other character traits of Desaguliers. He was an occasional poet and an actor, right? So this guy does everything. Which is really important for setting up why he was so influential in joining Freemasonry, as well as becoming Grand Master. So we talked about his stint in the Royal Society. I think I covered most of my points there. So let's talk about and shift over to his Masonic career. What do we know him as a Mason? Well, in fact, we don't know much about how he got started as a Mason, because if he is the third Grand Master, that means he had to have been a Mason prior to what we know is the organization and collection of the Premier Grand Lodge of England in 1717.
Right.
So we think he was initiated and passed, not raised, because there was no third degree at the time, right, somewhere between 1712 and 1715. Because at this point of the circles he was in, this is probably early Royal Society days, like his joining was a social coup. Like, we want this guy who everybody knows, everybody likes. He's a prop comic. He's like, he's everywhere. We want him in into the fraternity. Which he then, as Reverend Dr. Brother Desaguliers, also teamed up with Reverend Anderson, right, to help get this thing off the ground, and help. Actually, I think in one of the latter prints of Anderson's Constitutions, Desaguliers wrote the foreword to, not the first one, but the, some of the subsequent ones later on.
Right, but they worked together on the 1723 copy.
Yes,
they worked together on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And so, in some of my research, thank you for that, because that helps me pull some threads where we think he had some influence in narrating the story, the embellishment of Freemasonry, because, you know, as we talked about in an earlier episode of TMR, how, you know, you look at Anderson's Constitutions, it says, look, it goes all the way back to Adam. We can trace Masonry all the way back then. It's meant to be a story. It's meant to build up the origin story of Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm. There's actually, from what I understand, I don't know too much about the fact behind this piece, but there has been a rumor out there that Desaguliers actually did most of the work on what became Anderson's Constitutions, but that because he didn't want his influence to drive the Constitution's publication and marketing, he let Anderson put his name on it. But I don't have a lot of facts to back that up. I just remember reading that in several little pieces out there going, well, it's believed because Anderson wasn't all that smart.
Mm-hmm. Well,
smart is the probably wrong way. Literate is the word.
That's a very important point. Robert?
This sounds very Baconian / Sherlockian. You know what I mean?
You mean Bacon and Shakespeare.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I do apologize. Shakespeare and Francis Bacon, you know, transposing those two. Who really wrote it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's also some thoughts on that, you know. Maybe that's another episode, right? Hidden authors. But there's also about who really wrote the Constitution also.
Mm-hmm. So,
of the United States, I should say.
There you go. So the, let's see. So we know 1717, he helped form the Premier Grand Lodge of England. Remember, at this point in time, Masonry was still in that transition state into speculative Masonry. Okay, so Jason's done a lot of history in Freemasonry in Scotland, and you know that it's very much an operative guild system, and the shift to speculative Masonry was pretty rough. In fact, you know, some lodges still hold on to their operative charters, right? Pre-Grand Lodge. And so here in London, because of the aristocratic nature of Desaguliers, it actually, to your point, Hammy and Robert, it would not have been a good choice to stick a snooty aristocrat over top of an operative system. Okay? So I think he was deliberately put on as a latter Grand Master, so that way you could ease in the operatives, like, because, you know, these operative lodges are doing their own thing. They're fine. They don't need this Grand Lodge to tell them what to do. But in a few short years, it goes from this decentralized network of lodges to now having a grand authority that can warrant and charter lodges in like a matter of like 5 to 10 years. So that's a big shift. But they had to be very careful that they didn't just stick some aristocrat as the first Grand Master. They needed to kind of ease into it so that transition could happen over a longer period of time.
Right. It and so you have like, in 17... Oh, go ahead, RJ.
No, you.
Because it makes sense then that you get Desaguliers in as Grand Master in 1719, and that's when he starts bringing in a lot of these noblemen as Masons, you know. And getting even those that have been, that were noble but were not as active, he brings them all back into being active because these are the guys he knows. He's bringing them in, and he's actually bringing it to the more speculative masonry and less operative side of things. And it keeps that flow going through into, obviously, when they say 1721, when you get the first, what is it, Duke of Montague, right? That becomes the Grand Master.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he becomes the Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge of England in 1719. Okay, so again, this is like, what, 5 years, possibly, of him being passed to the degree of Fellowcraft, because there's no third degree yet, which is fascinating. So, obviously, he has not had much of a long Masonic career to put him right there at the top. In fact, I don't think there's any record of him being Master of a Lodge or anything by that point in time. So another piece of evidence, it's like he was just stuck there as a figurehead, because that never happens in Masonry, right? So you put a popular guy in charge despite his experience.
Somebody's going to expel you for saying that.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Well, it kind of makes sense to your point, though, John, because now you've got somebody who's coming into the fraternity who has influence and an ability. Like, let's just say if you want to get something off the ground, an organization, for whatever the means may be, maybe you want to be one of these people who says, like, you know, nefarious reasons, and you want a group of people who can control government or whatever, you know, likely not those things. But if you want to grow, you need to put somebody in there who's able to help you grow. And I think he was one of those people who just had this influence. It's not uncommon, right? Like,
right.
When we did Masonic Presidents, you posted the picture, you pulled it up. Scottish Rite makes him an honorary Scottish Rite Mason. This is, of course, Ronald Reagan. You just pick somebody of prominence. You get brownie points immediately just for having been associated with such a person. I don't know. It feels that way anyway.
It does. Yeah, no, I see your point. Absolutely. So, So he becomes Grand Master, and then about 3 years or 2 years later, 1721, he's documented to have gone to visited a lodge of Edinburgh in Scotland, August 1721. And what's there is we find that there's probably good evidence of the conversations that were there either helped him shape or finalize the form of what we know now as the third degree. Because at this point in time, in 1721, there is no evidence of a Master Mason degree being held, conferred, titles given to. So, but we do know that date really influenced a lot of his nudging of the third degree. So there is a recent article from the Quattro Coronati Lodge, just came out this past year, in fact, where it really gives a lot more evidence and credence to Desaguliers helping to shape and create the third degree of Masonry, or at least as we would recognize it today. So let's talk about the third degree. Some aspects of the third degree were actually currently in the Fellowcraft degree, including points of fellowship and the giving of the Mason's word. In fact, that's why it's called the points of fellowship, because it is for the fellow craft, hence the name. But what we do find later, this is 1721, he meets the lodge in Edinburgh, and then we actually see some evidence by 1725 of Master Masons being made in Scotland and other places. Also, when you look at the difference between the first two degrees and the third degree, the third degree is full of lots of New Testament references as compared to Old Testament references in the previous degrees. Being an ordained minister really helps to help shape these things, as well as being an actor, a poet, a scientist. You can see all of his background is coming in to shape this thing into a third degree system. And in fact, part of the smoking gun of at least tying Desaguliers directly attributable to part of creating the third degree comes from this thing called the Briscoe pamphlet. And the Briscoe pamphlet was really a critique or criticism of the degree work that was going on at the time. And I'm going to quote some of this because it actually calls him out by name. Where it says, you know, this is just an excerpt, but our learned doctor of laws, to show his extraordinary reading, takes a great deal of pains to prove that Hiram, the founder in brass, a Tyrian, was not Hiram King of Tyre, when as the sacred text is so expressly plain in these words, and the King Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, worker in brass, and he was filled with wisdom and understanding, and cunning to work in all works of brass. Thus far, the holy penman, but the most ingenious Dr. Desaguliers, to make this Hiram, who was a founder and carver in brass, a stonecutter, or Freemason, as you may suppose, has found out the very letter of recommendation which King Hiram sent to Solomon, which runs thus, and now I have sent a cunning man, endued with understanding, skillful now, to work in gold, silver, brass, iron, stone, timber, purple, blue, and fine linen, and crimson, also to grave any manner of graving, like engraving, and to find out every device which shall be put upon him. Here you find our Freemason now as a mere jack of all trades, a goldsmith, a silversmith, a brazier, an ironmonger, stonecutter, timber merchant, sawyer, carpenter, or joiner, and a linen draper, and a fine scarlet dyer. When all it's said in the Book of Kings is, will we read no more of him than he was a founder of castor or brass and other metals. So what we're seeing here is a critique of this newly found third degree. He'd already created this Hiramic legend by now 1723. So this is again, the critique is dated 1723 with his name on it, saying how he's embellished the characteristic of Hiram as of not Hiram of Tyre. Not King Hiram of Tyre. And so we do find the earliest recorded raising of a Master Mason was on 1 February 1725, just 2 years later. So I find that to be not quite a smoking gun, but a pretty darn good evidence of his name being tied to the creation of this third myth. And so we do have evidence of the Master Mason degree being worked in Scotland by 1725. So, you know, he went on to be very active with the Grand Lodge system for many, many years after that. He died on the 29th of February, 1744. And from his days as Grand Master in 1719 to 1744, was still very active in establishing, forming, growing the Grand Lodge system. Lodges started being chartered left and right, based, you know, just for many years after that. So it really started taking off. And, you know, just kind of like what we would consider like a district deputy Grand Master for at least three other times after being Grand Master. So again, he wasn't a slacker after jumping right into that Grand Line. And so died on 29 February 1744, was buried on 6 March 1744 within the Savoy Chapel in London. So that's how his story ends. But I just, in conclusion, wanted to kind of tie it back that this guy was truly a Renaissance man of his time, coming from just pretty much, you know, penniless to be very in tune with his faith, be known to lecture and orate with his faith as a minister, become fascinated with science, get in the right scientific circles, and become part of, you know, the ground floor of Freemasonry, where it was very, very politically savvy. I mean, they really don't say that, but you can read between the lines, as we talked about earlier, politically savvy enough to be at the right place at the right time, know the right people to really help shape and grow that. And again, just my personal, like, infatuation with kind of the esoteric spiritual side of Masonry. It's good to see. I really wanted to see what was it specifically he added in at a third degree, and really couldn't get a whole lot out of the research. But, you know, he definitely left an impression on Freemasonry going forward. And I think that's something admirable that we should all, you know, respect and you know, look back upon. So that's all I got. What questions do you have?
I was going to ask you about your final question there. What real influence did he have on his third degree? And the only thing I can think of is, like, you know, we're data dudes. So, mm-hmm. of course, all I'm thinking of is, like, what are the books that are being published in that time? What do we see as, like, the en vogue topics in discoveries? What are these organizations really talking about in the years? You know, we don't have to look too far, like 1710 to 1725. What is going on there? What's in vogue? What are these people talking about? And then you can kind of see who's talking about what, and then maybe have a better idea. I mean, it's always going to be kind of a, smoky glass, you know, to figure it out. But
yeah, there is the reference. And I know Jason has done more research into it than I have, about the Noahide play, where, you know, we have Shem, Ham, and Japheth trying to receive some secret knowledge from their father, even after he's dead. And so they have a recasting of that story to the third degree as we know it today. And some of my sources say, well, you know, that there might not be a direct link there, that in fact, that Noachite degree may actually be a fabrication as well. Hammy?
Yeah, I was going to say, because before you brought that up, I was sitting here waiting for my opportunity. When Anderson's Constitutions get published, there is that the Freemasons were cast as the Noachides,
the
followers of the seven laws of Noah. And it includes the seven laws of Noah. Do not deny God. Do not blaspheme God. Do not murder. Do not engage in incest, adultery, pederasty, or bestiality. Do not steal. Do not eat of a live animal, and establish court's legal system to ensure obedience to the law. And those are that's masonry in so many ways, you know. And the fact is, though, I mean, what makes me even more curious about that whole connection there is the fact that we know that Desaguliers helped with the Anderson's Constitutions, and yet he drove us away from the Noachide degree system to the Hiramic legend instead. It almost begs the curiosity why, you know. Yeah. Unless he had his, you know, own reasons, or that it was more widely used is a good thing, I would say, but, you know.
I will add a little bit of an epilogue that our friend and brother P.D. Newman published in the Fraternal Review back in October of 2019, where they noted that prior to Desaguliers' stint as Grand Master, there was no mention made in the Masonic ritual of a sprig of acacia. And rather, the reference was to a sprig of cassia, a cinnamon-like plant originating in southern China. And so you have to wonder if there was some sort of hallucinogenic influence from Desaguliers, right? If he's dabbling in all these other things, dabbling in alchemy, that there should be some sort of ethnogenic type of influence as well. And so he says you can't show a direct correlation, but prior to Desaguliers coming in and messing with the script, it went from cassia to acacia. It wasn't a mistranslation. There was a deliberate change.
That's fascinating to me, because all I can think about, like, the comedy writer in me just wants to see, you know, like Daryl Hammond portraying Bill Clinton, you know, like passing a joint. And now I want to see Desaguliers being like, check thee out. This is the substance. My brothers.
Yes. Like, I'm picturing, like, you know, Moses coming down with the 15 crash 10 commandments, right? But it's like, it's the cassia. I mean, acacia. It's acacia, guys. It says it right here. It says acacia the whole time. I don't know what you've been reading.
I need Brady McQueen to make a cartoon.
The question, without getting into too much of the detail on it, though, is that can the cassia, not the, you know, not the alchemical side of it or the, mm-hmm. you know, the drug-based side of it, can it do the same thing as the acacia that we know is part of the symbolism why we use the acacia? I mean, that would be a question to look into to see if that's why he even made the switch too, for that matter.
It does seem to fit in the sense of objective and similar notions, I suppose, within all religions, organized or not. There is this element of the not a true transmigration of souls, but the plant itself, as we use it today, embodies that idea. Right. Whereas I think maybe the cassia might have a more difficult time making a correlation to the degrees as they exist today. Mm-hmm. But I mean, obviously I don't have a mind to be changed. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Juan, any questions you've had, any thoughts, any research you found about this guy?
The one thing that stood out the most for me that was most interesting, you alluded to it when you mentioned that the parallels between him and Leonardo da Vinci. Not only was he a brilliant mind that utilized illustration as a tool for not just convincing people of the science of the time, but to be able to procure support for further research. And you see the same with this, the Segoulier, because he actually has connections with the royal family. He would do experiments for them and thereby not just get their support, you know, from a nod, a royal nod, but also financially. So you can see how attractive it would be to have someone of his stature and his connections to be part of this great experiment of a unified Freemasonry through the Grand Lodge. He also had a parallel with Leonardo, where he was estranged from his father early on. So you see the dynamics that play. If you think of Leonardo da Vinci, he spent the rest of his life trying to impress other men. And I wouldn't put that past this individual. It's like part of his overachievement comes from that insatiable desire to for recognition or for approval of sorts. So I just thought it was very interesting that he, you know, they share that parallel. And I didn't find anything, you know, of course I have, just like some of the things that you've mentioned, my suspicions of, oh, could he have had some influence in the, for example, the development of the third degree, or, you know, what hand did he play in that, considering that he was so comfortable utilizing illustrations, and he was familiar, of course, with Newton's study of the proportions of the Temple of Solomon and all that kind of stuff. Like, could he have been part of the instrument that brings that that whole story into the fold? But who knows? It's just interesting.
All right. Okay, so we're at that time now to start wrapping up the conversation. I want to ask everyone the final question. And the final question, starting with Hammy, is, do you think that Freemasonry would be the same had De Segoulier not been in the fraternity? What are your thoughts?
No, I really don't. To be honest, the amount of influence that I could find in everything that I've read about him, without him, I have a feeling it might not have gone as far as it did. You know, I'm not saying that it would not have lasted, you know, a couple hundred years as well. I'm just saying that I don't think without his influence, without his bringing back the less active members that he knew about, and bringing in a lot of the nobles that he did bring in as well, which then continued this on into a much larger scale, I don't think it would have carried on as well. I do know that, you know, obviously we had, you know, eventually the ancients, because the premier was actually the moderns, start up. But I don't know if we would have ended up in that direction even, you know. It's hard to say, but without his influence, it would not be what it is today. I don't even know if we'd have a third degree without him.
So I'm going to have to agree with you on that. Okay. Juan, what say you? Do you think masonry would be the same, different, had he not been involved?
Well, I'm not sure how much of an influence directly. I'm not sure that I see a direct link with how it ended up, but it does show me the importance that we don't operate in a vacuum. It doesn't matter how great one individual is within the organization. It is it's a guild, and it's a matter of all of us connecting together to do the very best for the organization. So would it be the same? You know, I don't know how the ripples would look. You know, would it be different? Yeah, perhaps, just like from a butterfly effect point of view. But more importantly is, I like the highlight of most Masons don't know the name de Ségolier, and yet he was very influential at the time. So we could have those same kind of individuals today who are very influential, yet their names will just be a footnote in the majority of the craft. But anyway, very interesting conversation. Thank you so much, brothers, for putting together the research. John, amazing presentation. I really enjoyed it. I had to remind myself, write some questions. Get involved. You're not just watching the Masonic Roundtable on YouTube.
Don't just grab the bag of popcorn and start going at it.
Yeah, I felt a little bit like that, but thank you so much for carrying the weight on this one. You did a great job.
Right. Thank you.
And thank you again, everybody, for listening to the Masonic Roundtable.
All righty. Robert, same, better, worse? What say you?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, when I think back about these kind of things, I think, honestly, you look at the history of Freemasonry as it existed prior to the speculative era, right? So you look at an operative guild type era, and people are taking their oaths on guild bylaws, agreeing to terms of employment, and all of these kinds of things. I mean, read them. But then we think, well, why on earth would an aristocrat have wanted to join such an organization? And I mean, I think if you think about that intrinsically, those reasons are probably apparent. No need to go into them here. But I think ultimately what it does is that Freemasonry probably would not have been anything like it is today without people at least like de Ségolier, meaning that with money and influence is equal to investing and sustainability in the thing that you're in. Whether or not that they were like, hey, let's get together and make sure this thing is sustainable and lasts for 300 years, might not have been in the cards, but it is no less a byproduct of their influence. If not de Ségolier, then who? What if in some alt timeline we're having the same conversation, but instead of him, we're talking about Newton? You know, did they approach a couple guys and say, look, we got this org, we need somebody? Did Newton go, talk to de Ségolier? He's kind of into that stuff. I'm busy, you know, being weird with my mysticism, you know, being cool. I think Masonry wouldn't be where it is today without somebody like him. but his particular areas of interest, if you had just had any old aristocrat in that position, no. We'd have a really prim and proper type organization, largely based around administrative qualities that have nothing to do with, I mean, if we're being open here, practical occultism, you know, day-to-day living with the mystic, mystical side of life. That's what these guys put on the line. That's what they arguably invested in and influenced our craft in that way. So, no. In short, that was the long. The short is, no, we wouldn't be the same, I don't think.
All right. No, I'm going to have to agree with you there. I mean, absolutely. Without this this gentleman who coming in, when he came in, with the connections that he had, both at the fraternity level, the Royal Society level, the upper level part of the government. It's just, it's something that the timing was right. He was in the right place at the right time with the right set of skills, and timing is everything, right? So fascinating guy, fascinating engineer, fascinating minister, fascinating Freemason, fascinating alchemist. I mean, just this guy, he was the whole package. And I really look forward to Rexham doing more deep dives into research on his life. So, yeah, I don't think that Masonry as we know it today would be there, especially in a third degree, that we can set up that three-tiered system that we're familiar with today. But certainly a great influence on the foundation and then therefore the future of the fraternity in 1719 going forward. So with that, I hope you enjoyed it. We really appreciate having you here. We'll see you next week, and thank you for watching, and keep searching for more light. Have a good night.
Wow.